Oh, before I speak to you, let me speak to the Lord so he will speak. Father, I have on my mind, my desire for the next several minutes is that you would renew this congregation to a true knowledge of who we are and of what fatherhood is according to the image of the one who made us. Renew us to a true knowledge according to the image of the one who made us. I pray for all that that means, that your Spirit would renew our minds and touch our hearts and give us understanding in a way that is transformative for us and our relationships and our fruitfulness in this life. In Jesus' name and for his glory. Amen. The title of my sermon this morning is Toward Wholesome Fatherhood. And I mean something specific in using that word wholesome, and we'll get to that later. When I say fatherhood, what pictures come to your mind? I'm going to show you a few pictures. These don't necessarily come to my mind, but I want to give some context. I'm 54 years old now, and over the course of my lifetime, honestly, I don't consider that super old, and especially the older I get, I don't consider it super old. But it's 5 decades. But in that time, I feel like I've seen the pendulum swing a couple times about this topic and a lot of other things. So back in the 60s, sort of the image of a fatherhood, and those of you who are younger, maybe I should point some things out. That guy on the upper left, that's Beaver Cleaver's dad. That's Ward Cleaver. That was a TV program that was, I think it first aired in the 60s, but it was in syndication in the 70s when I was a kid. So, I watched it every day after school. So that was Beaver's dad. He was a kind of a representative character. Then in the lower left, I think everybody probably knows who that is, but for those who don't, that's John Wayne. That was the stereotypical image of a macho man back in the 50s and the 60s. And before him, it was Humphrey Bogart in the 40s, and it was the same type of guy, that was kind of the popular image of fatherhood. Fathers were mostly, in that era, fathers were mostly defined by what they did outside the home, by their work. And home and children, that was the domain of women, predominantly, and in some homes, almost exclusively. And dads, not all dads, throughout all history, dads come in lots of different shapes and sizes. That's always been true, but cultures have a lens, and they have a message that you're supposed to be, an image. And the image of a man and of a dad back in the 60s and the 50s was, a stoic guy, not encouraged to be relational. If he was that by nature, there were certain rules that you kind of had to abide by. There was a particular bent. A father's primary role was as breadwinner and disciplinarian. And, in some homes, the mantra was kind of, wait till your father gets home. Your children lived in that sort of dad is bad cop and mom is good cop, period. Then in the 70s, there was a big rebellion. The pendulum swung, way the other way. Suddenly men were supposed to be sensitive and relational. And, there was a reason for that. That 60s machismo stuff wasn't so healthy. And so, the culture swung away from that. And it was, but it was kind of confusing. It was like, okay, now what? And, you know, this guy in the upper right, you know, that's Alan Alda. He was sort of the poster child for the new man, the new sensitive relational guy. And he was on a program called MASH. But he was kind of a lightning rod. You know, some people really embraced that, and some people, he was like the enemy. But it was, you know, I'm not taking sides. I just am illustrating how confusing it was to try to figure out, well, who should I be? Should I be this guy or should I be this guy? And it was, they were that far apart. And then it kind of got crazy at some level. You know, it's, you know, the hippies had children, and you know, there were no rules for that. what's a dad? It was up for grabs. Then in the 80s, the pendulum swung back the other way, back to the conservatives. In traditional forms, you know, a lot of people rallied around Ronald Reagan, and that was a whole movement. There were other people of color, who the good part of the 80s is with it. Some things were opening up, some things were changing. There were new voices. There were new families on TV. But even, you know, this is the Cosby Show, for those of you who are too young to know. My kids would probably say that, that's a bougie family too. Because it was all very middle class. It was all very middle class, sort of staid 1980s stuff. Not the 70s. It was intentionally not the 70s. Then in the 90s, I'm a Gen Xer, and you know, people that moved faster than I did. Some of my peers started having children in the 90s. I didn't, but some of them did. And the younger baby boomers were having kids, and our generation was a lot more involved with our children, more than our parents were with us. But some people might say that we were a little too involved at times, to the point of being helicopter parents. So that whole phase came in. And you know, some other things other cultural ideas have been expressed, you know, between the 90s and now, for sure. A lot of things, you know, every different choice up here, plus some others that are not on here. You know, I ran out of space, and also, frankly, it's dizzying what's out there now. But here's what I want to say. In 2021, I think we're sort of towards the tail end of the culture wars. You know, they've been fought out, and it feels to me like that's what it feels to me. Our society no longer has any clear definition for what a father should be, or what a lot of other things should be, frankly, for a lot of reasons. But especially because, you know, we just don't really agree on hardly anything important at all anymore. It's just everything is an argument. And it's complicated how we got here. I'm not going to try to unravel all that. I'm just pointing out it's hard to live like that. It's hard to live when there isn't agreement about really basic things. And I think it's, I feel for my kids, and your kids and their kids, what's coming, it's hard to live in the midst of confusion and conflict constantly. It's not good. It's not good. And it's not good to have only question marks in your head. So I want to speak into that a little bit this morning. And Kati, you already started out, and I just want to say amen to what you said. When you look around at our country today, clearly we all need some wiser guidance. We all need some wiser guidance. And I don't think the answer is going back to old stereotypes. That's not what I'm gonna say this morning. I don't have nostalgia for the old things. Some of it was good, and I'm not a person that throws the baby out with the bathwater, that's important. But I don't think the answer is going back to some old era, nor do I think the answer is making it up as we go. You know, constantly having a question mark in your head and coming up with a different answer every day. I don't think that works either. So I'm going to give you the answer this morning, right? No, not really. More than giving you the answer, what I want to do this morning is to start a conversation. And I'd like to start that conversation in the safest place that I know, which is in the Bible, in the midst of a loving congregation. I think we can have this conversation together with each other and with the Lord. Then I need to warn you, because this is such a delicate topic, this is gonna be a long sermon. This sermon is gonna go an hour. But I thought about this hard. I tried to make it shorter, and I just decided, I think this sermon is worth speaking in its fullness. And here's why. So I'm asking forgiveness ahead of time. I'm asking for you to indulge me. I think this is going to be worth it. I do. The topic is delicate enough. I mean, people are fighting about this. The church is fighting about this stuff. I need to be careful, and to be careful, I need to take my time. And it's also important. It's important for us to have this conversation and not duck it. The church does need to speak into this, but in a way that's not angry, that's not reactionary, and that doesn't contribute to more dysfunction. So in order to do that, this sermon has a lot of nuance to it. You know, I'm using words carefully, and I'm giving a lot of context so you understand what I mean and what I don't mean, because I don't want to be I want to be helpful and not harmful. So I'm going to take my time. So I hope you'll bear with me. And I hope that everybody here, even if you're not a father and you never will be a father, I hope that the Lord will give you something to take away. And I think he will. I think he will, because this is so fundamental to who we are. Fathers are heads of families, and family is the foundation of the church and of society. And it is the image of God. And I'm going to talk all about that this morning and tie that stuff together so you can see who Jesus is in fatherhood. So enough introduction. Let's get to the Bible. We're going to be in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, and we're going to look at a little bit of what Paul has to say about fatherhood. He's writing to a church in Thessalonica, which is in modern-day Greece, and he's giving them, he's telling them about his ministry. He's to try to encourage them. Here's what he says. For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain. For we never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others, even though as apostles of Christ we might have asserted our authority. But instead of doing that, we proved to be gentle among you, as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. Having so fond an affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you had become very dear to us. For you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day, so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, you saw it, and so did God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behaved towards you believers. Just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children, so that you would walk in a manner worthy of the God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. Let me give you a little introductory disclaimer before I continue. I just want to acknowledge, Paul did not write this passage for a Father's Day sermon. He didn't write this passage to explain fatherhood, but rather he wrote this to explain his own ministry. However, in the process of doing that, I think he gives us a couple of snapshots that are important for understanding what mature Christian leadership is. He wasn't just describing himself in a vacuum. He was describing himself for the purpose that other people would imitate it. So he's showing us what mature Christian leadership is, and by extension, I think, what mature Christian fatherhood is. So, point number one, what is mature Christian fatherhood from this passage? I think it begins with discipline. If you look at verses 9 through 11, which is up on the screen, what I see here is the God-given role of a father. This is what a father is supposed to be. He's supposed to have a work ethic, you know, labor and hardship. He's supposed to exhort, he's supposed to encourage, because Paul says that's what a father would do his own children. So I think Paul is articulating a God-given role, something that God intended for fathers. And I think God typically gives strengths to men to fill this role, to uphold discipline in the home. That is a really core identifiable part of being a father. However, this role is bigger than any man is. The role needs to be articulated, but nobody starts out like that. A man has to grow into this role, and God gives strengths for it. And those strengths are typical strengths. What do I mean by typical? I'm using the word typical really carefully because I'm really aware at this point in my life, not all of these strengths, you know, work ethic, exhorting others, you know, saying the right things to help them go the right way, and encouraging them, coming alongside them to help them continue in the right way. That doesn't come naturally, equally naturally to every guy. These strengths are normative to a man. They're normative masculine strengths that fit God's design for a father, but some of these strengths are more intuitive to some men than to others. Some of it depends on your personality. I mean, I have three boys, and they have different personalities, and so how they relate to discipline, how they get from A to B is different based on their personality, and that's just, God just made them that way. I feel it necessary to say that out loud because it, you know, when you talk about roles and when you talk about ideals, values, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. All men have to go towards that North Star, but the way you get there is going to look differently based on your personality, based on the kind of family that you grew up in. You know, an Italian family is going to do this a lot different than a German family, probably. And that God made that. And so, but we need to acknowledge that when we're giving instruction. So I just want to acknowledge that we all start in different places, and we go towards the same thing, but we get there through different paths, and that is also God-given. Bottom line. All males, men and boys, have to work at these typical strengths and practice it over and over again to be able to express it maturely. Mature fathers don't drop out of the sky. God makes it like pottery. He starts with a lump of clay, and he starts working on it. It takes a long time to make it strong and then make it beautiful. We're just like that. Enough preamble. Let me talk about these three specific qualities. First of all, work ethic, labor and hardship. Paul Paul is talking about how he did his ministry. He modeled what it is to work hard. A father needs to do that for his kids. To give them a work ethic, not by just telling them, but by showing them. Because life is hard, and there's no way around that. There is no free lunch, and dad is the one that teaches you that. You have to get up every day. You have to go every, you know, Francis, the little badger's dad says, Francis, everybody has a job. I go to my work and you go to your studies and you do your study and I do my work. We all have a job. We learn that from our fathers. And that's so important. And part and parcel of that work is hardship. You know, work often occurs in conditions that are not ideal. You know, when Paul came to Thessalonica, it wasn't a bed of roses. There were a bunch of Jews that didn't like what he was saying and didn't want people to follow him and didn't listen to them. And so they showed up and they protested. And it wasn't just signs, you know. Sometimes they had vegetables and they had rocks and they had sticks. And Paul was operating in that environment, but he wasn't intimidated. You know, fathers teach you not to be intimidated by the negative things, the hard things. You know, Paul modeled that to the Thessalonians. Fathers need to model that to their kids. It gives them backbone. So example is hugely important. Secondly, exhorting. A father has to give clear direction. You know, I'm noticing this as I watch my son playing, my six-year-old boy learning soccer. It's a hoot to watch six-year-olds play soccer. It's a lot like Charlie Brown. You know, the ball goes in one direction, and about 10 kids all go like that. It's funny because they're learning. But there's so much to soccer. Soccer's kind of a complicated game. And when the adults play it's all orderly and, you know, it looks, you know, like it makes sense. When kids play it, not so much. They need to be told things like, here's your position and go do that. And there's this lovely woman that was on the field yesterday, and she talked the whole game. She would call kids by name and she would say, come on, move up. It's time to move up. No, you go over there. Run to the ball. She was giving the appropriate direction to the appropriate kid in the appropriate part of the field. And I just went, oh, that is a lot what parenting is, what fathering is. You give the right instruction to the right kid in the right way in the right part of the field. That's what exhorting is. It's giving clear direction and doing it not just after things have gone wrong. Hey, what are you doing? That's not the best kind of exhortation. The best kind is the thoughtful kind where you see things about to happen and you intercept it and give some direction before it happens. And even back up the truck, ideally you start exhorting before anything even happens. You explain, this is what the boundaries are. Don't do that, but do this. And then even go farther, you know, a mature dad will even go farther than that and say, here, let me show you how to do this. Now you try it. That's all part of exhorting, and it bleeds, you know, when you're doing it well, it bleeds quickly into encouraging, not just giving words, but coming alongside and helping. That's easy to describe, really hard to do. You know, ask any man in the room, it's hard to be a good dad, especially 24 hours, 24/7. Because encouraging, you can't just talk. You have to watch and listen to encourage well. You know, I have 5 kids and they're all different. I can't talk to them all in the same way. I have to know which child I'm talking to and how they're wired, how to motivate them, this one versus that one. I have to be honest about my own weaknesses and remember, oh, I was a kid too once. This is hard when you don't know X, Y, and Z. And oh, that's right, they don't know X, Y, and Z yet. They don't know A, B, and C yet. So let's slow down and speak with age-appropriate expectations. Boy, it took me a long time to have the right expectations. My expectations when I started out as a dad were way up here. It was just kind of a flat line, way over my kids' heads and over my head. And over 20 years, I've learned, start slow. And you know, honestly, how I learned that is by watching my wife. My wife taught me how to have age-appropriate expectations because I had no idea. Which is a good transition into my next topic. I think in the old days, fatherhood stopped right here. It was just discipline. Christian fatherhood, it doesn't stop here. Christian fatherhood is bigger than that, and it's more integrated than that. Christian fatherhood, like anything that's going to be Christian, it's perfected by love. Love is the classic role of a mother. I would even go so far as to say the God-given role of a mother. There's a divine reason why when my son scrapes his knee on the sidewalk outside, he will run past me into the house looking for mom. That's a God thing because of these verses. God made mothers to be gentle and to care tenderly. You know, women have these instincts. Women don't always know they have these instincts, but when they have a baby, these instincts like wake up and they start coming out. That tender care starts coming out, finding a place. That's what's on Paul's mind here. Let me make this really straight. Paul is this middle-aged guy. He's probably about my age when he's writing this, in his 50s, not married. And this guy is like, take no prisoners. He comes to a town and he starts telling people what's what. And if you argue with him, he'll win. He won't be mean, but he'll win. You know, he's a force to be reckoned with. And he is that guy. It's that guy is saying, my ministry towards you, you remember how I was with you, Thessalonians? I cared for you in the same way that Bai cares for Isaac. Like a mom who's breastfeeding her baby, I care about you that much and in that kind of, with that kind of carefulness. You know, as scary as I could be, I dial myself way down so that you know that this isn't a power thing. Christianity is not a power thing, it's a love thing. And you'll never get that with me just saying words. But I was with you in a certain way, and that way was like a mom is with her baby. It was tender, it was gentle, it was affectionate. The core, one part of the core of my message this morning is that a man like that can only learn to be gentle and caring and tender by learning it from a woman. Mothers are so hugely important. What Bai is doing right now is so important. And so important that God gives grace for it. God gives a very specific grace to a woman that he doesn't give to a man to excel at these qualities. Let me talk about what these qualities are. Oh, wait, before I do that, I want to repeat the disclaimer so as to take the pressure off. Just like men, women come in a lot of different packages and they come in a lot of different personalities and they come from different families. So gentleness and caring and affection look different in different families and in different personalities, and God made it that way. This is not a, you know, read this verse and you'll all look the same. That's not what I'm saying. This is a standard that God has set, and he gives grace in a variety of ways to a variety of personalities to carry this out. And so the pressure's off. You don't have to be a cookie cutter. This isn't about cookie cutter. Well, what is this about? Let me talk a little bit about these words. Gentleness. You know, when I think of gentleness, it's a carefulness. You control your body, you control your voice, you control your attitude in a way that communicates something that goes beyond words, that, hey, this is a safe environment. A mother that taps into what God's given her and practices at it gets really good at this. I mean, just, you know, when my wife walks into the room, you know, something happens that doesn't happen when I walk into the room. And it just, that's just how it is. There's an environment that a woman, a gentle woman, creates in a home. And that is such an important, lovely thing in a home. Not just for child raising, by the way, but just for hospitality. To create a space where it's safe and where people want to interact and relate, that's what gentleness does, and you have to cultivate that. You have to work at that. Tender care. Let me just use the picture Paul uses. To define tender care, Paul uses the picture of a breastfeeding mother, which I think is that's a picture of intimacy. You know, it's so close. It's between mom and baby. And there's a deep giving there. The mom is literally giving of herself to nourish and to love that baby. And in the process of doing that, it forms such a strong bond. I mean, that bond, that's part of why my kids run past me to Jenny's, because she breastfed them, and they're bonded to her in a very special way that is, like, sacred. Paul is using that as an illustration of how intimate Christian love is and how important. What's at stake here is a baby. No matter what's happening in a given day, the baby's the most important thing. Pastors need to remember that. Politicians need to remember that. Dads need to remember that there's a baby to be defended and protected. In a way that's very careful and that's very, I will sacrifice myself for that baby. That's what Paul is saying. Moms show us that physically with their bodies. We need to imitate that. Even men need to imitate that kind of self-giving. And Paul is holding himself out. He said, I was like that with you. I sacrificed myself. And here, what he says, why? Because you had become very dear to me. That's not just rhetoric. He really loved these people enough that he did sleepless nights like a mom. He denied himself. He didn't get paid, but he did hard work even though he wasn't getting paid because he loved these people. He didn't want them to continue to worship idols and suffer the consequences of that. You know, when you worship idols, it wrecks your life. And Paul understood that because he used to worship idols. And his idols were tricky because he was a religious person, but he still had idols. And it took Jesus to show him, dude, you worship idols. Because you want to kill people when they get in the way of your idols. That's not love. That's not how a mother is with her child. She protects the baby. He learned that from Jesus. And so after that, he wanted other people to have that love, to know that love, and the only way to do it was for him to sacrifice himself. That's the kind of leader he was, because that's the kind of leader Jesus is. So I need to summarize now. I've given you two snapshots. Snapshot one, what a father naturally is, you know, discipline. Snapshot two, what a mother naturally is, and what God makes of a woman. You know, you have to work at it. I think that these snapshots, they form two sides of a toolbox. You know, men, because this is Father's Day, I'm going to give you a Father's Day analogy. You know your toolbox at home and that tray in the top of the toolbox? You know, it's got two sides to it. And you've got screwdrivers on one side and wires and a bunch of other junk on the other side. I think discipline and love are two sides of that same tray. It's the same tray. You need it to do your work. If you're gonna do effective work, you gotta have a whole toolbox. You gotta have something on the left side, you gotta have something on the right side. You gotta have some discipline, you gotta have some love. To simplify that, dad plus mom equals maturity. If you're gonna be a mature father, you gotta have two sides of your toolbox. And so you gotta be shaped by the masculine and the feminine. To be a mature Christian leader, or what I'm calling a wholesome father, a man needs to be developed both by masculine strengths and feminine strengths. Another way of putting that is that a mature father is both an officer and a gentleman. You know, you can lead the charge, but you can also dial it back and be at home and relate to your wife and relate to your kids. And I think if you read 1 Thessalonians 2 carefully, that's what Paul is saying about himself. He's putting himself forward as an example of this wholesome maturity. Hey, Thessalonians, I got a toolbox with two sides in it. Because my ministry expresses the strengths of both a father and a mother. He calls it out back in verses 7 through 11. So as I realized that, the question comes to me. I think you know, if there were people here who don't believe the Bible or just have honest questions, they might ask me. So okay, Mike, is this guy saying that men should be like women? And my answer to that is yes and no. First of all, let me give you the no part. Just for clarity's sake, because the culture around us, I don't think, has this right, but the church needs to have it right. I think Paul clearly believes that mothers and fathers have some important differences, that they're not alike. They're equal in value, but they're different. Based on the way God made us. You know, God made a woman's body and her insides to have a baby and nurture a baby, and he didn't make men like that. And that has a lot of implications to it. On the other hand, God made men in a certain way. Then women are not like. And that's from God. There is a God-given difference between men and women. Paul understands this, and I think he implies this, when he, back in these passages, he's associating these qualities specifically with a woman, and he's associating those qualities specifically with a man. He believes that there's a difference. And you see that in other passages, in other parts of the New Testament, when Paul's talking about gender. You know, in Corinthians, for example, he critiques the men in that church as not embracing these qualities enough, that they're not being manly enough. And so they're out of bounds. They need to return to the model. Not that they need to be cookie cutters, but they need to not be confused, because there is a difference between men and women. However, if you look at 1 Thessalonians 2, here's the yes part. Yes. Men, Paul does expect men to be like women. We clearly see that Paul expects that, because he puts himself out there as like a nursing mother. How can this apostle be like a nursing mother if he doesn't want other men to be like that? There's something about leadership that has to be shaped by a woman, otherwise it's not whole and it's not effective. So to summarize that, I think what Paul is after, because it's true, because Christianity is a whole thing and not a half thing, it's a full toolbox and not a half toolbox, male-female is not just an either-or, male-female is an either-or, but fatherhood and motherhood is not just an either-or, it also includes a both-and. Because a both-and is necessary to express the fullness, the wholesomeness wholesome. I'm using the word wholesome not just to mean nice and good, feels good, but as it's full and it's integrated. It's two things in one. Just like a marriage. How do you get children in a marriage? Male and female. How did that start? God created us that way. When God created man, in the Hebrew it says God created Adam, and the very next thing it says is male and female he created them. So the first definition of Adam is not that guy that was by himself in the garden to begin with. The original definition of Adam is more like Adam Eve. It's the male-female creature that I made to reflect who I am. You know, God is, you know, the thing about Christianity that drives all the other religions bonkers is that our God is three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. They're a unity. They always operate together. Where you find one of them, you find the two others. You can't separate them, but they're distinct persons. You can't even explain that. Human beings are a lot that way. We're made in that image. When God said he made us in his image, what he's talking about partly is that you're not just one thing. You're not just an Adam. You're an Adam Eve. You're an Adam Eve. When God says man, he almost always means Adam Eve. It's male, female together because that's what produces the fruit. That's what produces the children biologically, but that's also what produces the children spiritually and brings them to maturity. That's why this stuff is so important. If a man is to become whole or mature, he must be shaped by both fathers and mothers, men and women. Men do need to retain their God-given male identity, like men are from Mars. Men are from Mars. There's certain stuff you can't teach a man because he's from Mars. But that identity is softened and expanded and balanced and shaped by relating to women. This means that it takes mothers and wives to help shape a wholesome father, to make a gentleman out of the natural soldier. It's not only a man-to-man thing. Important footnote. We're not doing so good at the man-to-man thing in 2021. That's a whole nother sermon that I'm not gonna preach today. I just wanna acknowledge that my heart goes out to so many younger men, because part of the consequences of the confusion about this and not giving attention to it is that boys don't have anybody to guide them into fatherhood. There is an indispensable place for a father to bring a boy to maturity, and a woman just can't do. And I want to make clear about that, as I simultaneously want to make clear that if men don't let women in, women influence them, they'll have only one half of the toolbox in another way that's not helpful. That was all a mouthful. But I feel compelled. I want to give you some illustrations, just partly to prove that this isn't just talk. I want to give hope and not just information. I want to give hope. I want to leave you with some pictures that are human pictures that come from my own story. Because it's not good enough to know the truth. We have to live this. Otherwise, the world will never get this. We cannot get into arguments with anybody in 2021 and win. The way to persuade people is through the Jesus way, by grace, connected with truth. And the best way to do that is that you live it. We show people the way by how we treat each other. That's what Jesus said. People will know that you guys are for real and have something important by the way that you get every bit of your theology right. That's not the way Jesus said that. The answer was by the way we love one another. And by the way, if theology is super important, I don't mean to dismiss it, but theology isn't everything. If we can't live it out, it's not effective. We have to go beyond the right ideas, and that's why my sermon is going to keep going. And I apologize for that, but I think it's worth it.
How do we get there from here? How do we help boys become mature fathers in 20, 30 years, over the course of 20, 30 years? Let me tell you what I've learned in my own journey. That thing's not working anymore. There we go. Maturity takes time. For example, it took me at least 15 years of marriage to become a really functional father. Just to begin to be functional. I still have a lot to learn. You know, age 54, you know, I don't know everything yet, for sure. And you know, quite frankly, I never will. Part of being a Christian is you understand that there's more. There's always more, because there's more people. There's different kind of people, and it Jesus is really big. Nobody does Jesus but Jesus. So if we're gonna be like him, it takes time. The older I get, though, a new hope is dawning in me. It's why I put this picture up. I've realized that God thinks it's normal to take a long time for somebody to grow up. God is not in a hurry to grow a person up. People are a lot more like trees than they are like flowers. You know, you are not annual flowers. You're a lot more like a tree. Starts out like a little acorn, and it takes a long time for acorn to look like that big tree. Fatherhood is a lot like that. I didn't get to where I am here overnight. It's taken a long journey. And you know what? That's normal. It's helpful to know that, though, when you're at the beginning. This is not a sprint. Maturity also takes, as I've been saying, the influence of both fathers and mothers. The role of parents is so important. Let me tell you a little bit about my own dad. What I received from my dad. These qualities, discipline. My dad had some strengths here. And let me tell you a little bit about my dad. My dad did not have a dad. He grew up in a home where there was not a man consistently present that he was related to. So he didn't have a mentor. But when my dad became a father, he gave me what he had. He sacrificed, and he taught. I learned work ethic from my dad. Most of you know this, some of you don't. My dad was a Minnesota Viking. He was a professional football player. So when I was a little kid, I watched him play every Sunday on TV. It was a hoot. It was fascinating. Loved it. But it was hard. My dad had 6 knee operations. It was hard on his body. But I watched him over a career of 12 years. Most guys don't last that long in the NFL. I watched my dad work hard at that craft, partly because he loved it, partly because that was the way he paid the bills. And I think partly because that's what men do. You know, beyond everything, my dad had an instinct for doing the right thing in terms of work. For example, you know, in the off season, in the summer, when a lot of the other Vikings were just kinda on boats and beaches and, you know, in Corona commercials, my dad would drive into town from our house in the country and run around the high school track by himself for a couple hours. And then he would stretch really carefully after his warm down and come home. And he had like a, before diet was a thing in sports, you know, before Tom Brady and his really meticulous cat diet, my dad was on this special diet. We hated it. There was no sugar in this diet, but my dad did it because that's what he needed to do to keep playing. That's what he needed to do to make his body work. I also watched him, you know, whatever my dad put his hand to do, he did it with all of his might. He did it with all his strength. You know, he got into leatherworking, and so he bought these books about how you make leather bags, and then he bought this super Cadillac German sewing machine called a Pfaff. and put it in our guest room in the garage, and he'd go out there for hours in an afternoon and take raw pieces of leather and start making these bags. And they were good. He got good at it. And he wasn't good at it to begin with, but he got better. He would go to this guy's house. I don't remember this guy's name, but he'd go to this guy's house that also made leather stuff. And they would talk about making bags for 2 hours. And my dad got good at making bags. Then he bought a tractor. I don't think my dad had ever seen anybody drive a tractor. He bought this John Deere tractor, figured out how to work it, and he would plow this big, it was like a half an acre plot in the back of our house. And my mom devoted like half of that to this huge garden that we had to weed. And so my work ethic got practiced as well as exemplified. But I'm so grateful that I grew up in a home where I saw my dad apply himself. And he taught me, part of what he was doing was he was pursuing excellence, but also he had a sense of responsibility. If I don't do a certain set of things, nobody else is going to do them, and other people are depending on me to get this done. My dad woke up like that every morning, and he modeled that to me. So that, you know, and when I was in sports, you know, if things went wrong, I couldn't blame teammates. My dad would not tolerate that. You know, you do what you can do, Mike. You do what you can do, and there's no, you know, you don't blame the referees, you don't blame the coach, you don't blame other people. You take responsibility for what you can control. My dad taught me that stuff by example and also by words. My dad taught me other things. Well, I do want to tell you one other thing. Because I want my boys to hear this. My dad, he modeled for me and he talked to me about courage. When I think about, you know, I don't consider myself a super courageous person. I have to talk to myself to be brave, frankly. But you know, whatever functionality I have in that area, I trace to my dad, because I remembered this distinctly. I was a hockey player growing up, and I remember Joe, you'll appreciate this. I often was on teams where I was kind of playing up. I was playing with bigger boys, you know, and I was a defenseman, Joe, like you. But in hockey, when you're a defenseman, it's very physical. You know this, you understand this. Even in soccer, it's that way. In hockey, even more so. And I remember, my dad went to all my games. And I remember on the way to one of the games, he initiated this conversation with me. I remember this conversation to this day, because it was important to me. Here's an example of encouragement. My dad gave me some of his courage. And the way he did it was, he just asked me, he said, Mike, when you're playing hockey, what things make you nervous? What are you afraid of? He kind of just asked me an open-ended question. And I said, well, you know, Dad, the thing that freaks me out the most about hockey, particularly as a defenseman, is when the puck goes into the corner and nobody's there yet. And I have to go get it, and then another guy from the other team is going to get it, and you don't know who's going to get there first. That's a little dicey to me. I don't like that feeling of getting there and then getting hammered. You know, that guy, what if this guy flattens me? You know, and so I just talked to me about that, and he helped me to name that as a fear, and then he talked to me about sports and how normal it is to be afraid. You know, he said to me, as a professional athlete, he said, if you don't have butterflies before a game, you're not a real human being and you're not healthy. Because when the whistle blows and you're gonna run into each other, that is a little scary, and you need to be respectful of that. And so he normalized that it was normal for a man to be afraid, but how you deal with it is that you name it and you face it and you develop strategies, you know? We talked about strategies about how you go into a corner. Honestly, there was something about that I think that helped me, because I went on to be, I was a good defenseman. I wasn't a very good skater or stick handler, but if the puck went into my corner, I usually came out with it. And if I didn't, other people didn't. That was my territory, and I got that from my dad. that's not all I got from my parents. I want to talk about my mom, and I'm so glad that you're here this morning, Mom, to hear this. There were a lot of things my dad didn't have. My dad didn't grow up in a Christian family. He didn't know the Lord. And he was a guy. And not only a guy, he was a jock. And jocks can be kind of one-dimensional. That's an is. I love my dad, and I love him to death. Every boy needs more than his particular dad can give him. That's normal. And part of that gets filled in right away by mom. And my mom was that for me. The most important thing I got from my mom, and not just by words, but through example, was a strong faith. Ever since I can remember, since I was younger than Simeon, my mom has held the Bible in high respect. I'm the person I am today because my mom read her Bible. I read my Bible because I watched my mom read hers. I have memories of being younger than Simeon and sitting in Bloomington Baptist Church next to my mom. And my mom had her Bible open, and she was listening to the sermon, and I had a little children's Bible, and it had pictures in it. And I would just sit by my mom, while the sermon was going on, I would just look at the pictures in my Bible. I was copying what my mom was doing, but I was looking at the pictures, and the Lord grabbed me right there. My life took a good turn right there, before I understood what the gospel was, or any of the what was in the Bible. I understood the Bible was important, that life came out of it, because it came out of it for my mom. And it went beyond that. It wasn't just the words. My mom's faith was active. I watched my mom in a little town that we grew up in express relational commitment. You know, every instinct I have for community, I feel like I got it in Princeton, Minnesota, watching my mom. We went to church, not just on Sunday morning, but also on Sunday night and on Wednesday night. Not because my mom was legalistic, but because she loved the people, and she understood that church wasn't just the place you go. It was the relationships you have. I learned that before I knew it was a thing, because my mom did that. She was in other people's homes, and so I was in other people's homes. And she would have loved to have them in our home, but that wasn't possible because my dad wasn't a believer, but that didn't stop my mom from doing community. We did community. I learned it from my mom. Faith is not just the book, it's the people. I learned that from my mom. I learned servanthood from my mom. As strong as my dad's work ethic was, my mom created a home for us every day. One of the things I am so grateful for, Mom, is I grew up in a, you know, it wasn't a perfect home, especially as an adult now that I know what all of the burdens you were bearing. But I'm so thankful that I wasn't aware of it, because our home was a home, and I know how much work it took to make that. Everything was always in order, and my mom was always working it, and she did that stuff sacrificially without complaint, and nobody poked her to do it. It was willing. You know, my image of what a home is, the comfortableness. My mom's family, my aunts and uncles, are so warm and natural. If you came over to our house when they were there, you'd fit right in. They would poke you and tell jokes, and before long you'd be laughing and giggling, and you know, there's no plastic on our furniture. We just are. My mom brought that into our home. My home was always comfortable. I just thought that was normal, until I grew up and I saw, oh, well, there's different kind of homes. Not that even any home is better than another. It's just I'm grateful for where I came from. Here's another disclaimer. I'm really aware at this age in my life, not everybody even has two parents. You know, my dad didn't have two parents, and the mother that he had really didn't pay much attention to him. A lot of people have lives like that, where, you know, they don't get much from their parents because their parents aren't given much, or they're not present. That's a reality. You know what? Jesus knows that. Jesus knows that and he cares about that. That's part of why we have church. Even if you come from a really healthy family with two parents who are godly, you still need more than they can give you. That's why we have church. Maturity takes not just parents, it takes a church. Because at church, God will fill in the blanks. You know, I had some deficits as a man, as a husband, as a father, partly because my dad had nothing. He gave me everything he had, but it wasn't whole. I still needed gaps filled, and I still do. And God has provided it to me through the church. There have been a series of men, I can't talk about them all. There have been a series of men God's brought in and out of my life to shape me. That's what happens at church. It's, we don't just sing songs. Relationships form that change your life for the better. I want to tell you briefly about one of them. First of all, I just want to acknowledge that this church has shaped me. I'm giving this sermon this morning because you guys mentored me. You collectively, you were there when I was young and didn't know anything. You modeled what it was to be a father, an elder. I still watch you, Mike. I was watching you yesterday. I wish I could be, I need to be more like that. I need to be more hospitable. I need to work harder at what you were doing yesterday. I just want to say thank you. You guys helped me grow up, and especially this guy on the right. This is our former pastor. Those of you who don't know him, that's Pastor Berube. He was our pastor two churches ago. Had a profound influence on my life. When I showed up at Christ Community in 1999, I was pretty disciplined. I had gotten that from both of my parents. I was full of biblical truth because of my mom. And I was also very one-dimensional, i.e. not very relational. And those of you who know me at all, you know I can still be that way sometimes. But it's not quite as stark as it used to be because I've matured. And a lot of that maturity happened through being mentored by Ned. For the first 10 years of my marriage, Pastor Ned used to have lunch with me regularly. At the beginning, it was once a week. I was a young, kind of frustrated Gen Xer, desperate to connect to an older man in a positive way, and kind of prickly. I wasn't an easy person to take on. Ned took me on for 10 years, and he taught me, the most important thing that Ned taught me was grace. God gives himself to other people relationally. Grace is not just a theological doctrine. Grace is how God cares for people relationally. And I got that because Ned cared about me like that. Ned related to me to show me that grace was relational, that people are relational, that God is relational. Those were kind of ideas in my head, but it became real relating to Ned. It changed my life for the better. And honestly, the reason why I took the audacious risk of continuing to talk this morning is because my heart for this church is that you will all have what I got. You know, Stephen, if you stick around here, I want you to have what I got. Joe, I want you to have what I got. My boys, I want you to have what I got. And you older guys, you're not dead yet. I want you to be able to give what you got. I want to do this with you. I want the next generation to benefit from what I got. Not because because it's me, but this is Christianity. This is what Jesus was doing. Maturity also takes, if you're a father, it takes marriage. And not just waking up in the same bedroom as with your wife, but the mutuality of marriage, working at it. Here's what I mean by that. Hands down, I became a better father, not just because of Ned. Ned could help me to a point, but what went even further was my wife's influence. Watching my wife, Let me back this up. This is my wife on steroids. You know, God gave her some extraordinary gifting, but she has worked at it. Yesterday, when I was practicing the sermon, this is a crazy guy analogy, but it's Father's Day, so I'm going to do it. The picture that came to me is my wife is sort of like the Michael Jordan of motherhood. God gave her some extraordinary gifts, but she worked hard at them. She practiced in the gym to get good at these things because she wanted to help other women. That my wife's vocation is to help other women get good at this. Not to be like Jenny, but to do it how they're made. I've watched my wife help other women, and she's helped me. By how she treats our children, and by how she's coached me over the years. Jenny has shown me how to understand our kids developmentally. Hey, Mike, they're not ready for that yet. Individually, hey, that kid's not like that kid, Mike. And essentially, hey, they're our kids. It doesn't, all that other stuff doesn't matter. You know, we'll just hang together and get through this. My wife has shown me practically how to care for our kids' needs. You know, to identify what they are and then to take some initiative to attend to them. She's modeled gentleness. You know, I particularly needed that. You know, I'm a hockey player. And sometimes I've done hockey in our home and my wife had the courage to say, hey, that's not okay. Don't check me. Don't speak to me like that. Don't speak to the kids like that. And she didn't do it in a disrespectful way, but I needed to have the mirror held up. And when I needed that, my wife did that. And I'm better for it. This is a thing for me because I had to work on it to have a peaceful home, and I wanted that. I wanted that. It because my wife pointed it out, it gave me a goal that I started working toward, that I still work toward. Conclusion. Yay! I would be remiss if I didn't say this, church. Maturity takes God. If I've said anything this morning, this is what I meant to say. Because this is what the culture around us is not going to say. Because they don't know God. And I don't fault them for that. You can't understand this if you haven't been loved by God. You don't know that God is real. And it's not just a bunch of humana humana at church. It's stuff really comes to your heart through relationships. People don't know that about God, but that's how God is. Fatherhood comes from God. Jesus taught us, you know, no matter whether you're Catholic or Lutheran or Anglican or Protestant, Jesus taught us all the same prayer, and we say it. What do we say? We say, in the Catholics, I love this. They call it the Our Father. That's the prayer Jesus taught us to pray, the Our Father. All of those groups, we pray to the same Father, and he relates to us in that way. That's another 10 sermons. The one key point I want to make about this sermon is that this God, you know, you can't, I put this up here for a reason. You can't picture what God is because he's three persons. You know, that those symbols represent Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That God is the authoritative definition for what a person is and therefore what a father is. That's what it means to be, that's what it means for us to be made in God's image. We are, there's something about male, female, motherhood, fatherhood that represents this. And if we're not going towards this, if we're going away from this, it's always going to be confusing. Whatever fatherhood is, it's going towards this and not away from it. And if you get confused about what this is, who God is, that, look at that picture. I picked that picture on purpose. That's Jesus down on his knees on the last night of his life on this earth, washing the feet of his followers. Not just because their feet were dirty, but because he wanted to show them what maturity is. That's what fatherhood is. It's getting down on your knees and cleaning up a mess you didn't make because you're that baby is so dear to you. This is our God, and this is who we are. Let me bless you with that. Father, I'm so glad that this is who you are, and I just want to bless your people. This is what a priest does. It names the name of God over the people. And so in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, I bless this congregation, Cornerstone Church, and pray that every man here would say thank you to their father today, and that every father would hear you say, well done, faithful servant. That the mothers and the wives would pray for their sons and their husbands, a blessing, and that our church would love one another in such a way that people that aren't here today, that are around us and they're watching for something good, they might see your goodness in us that we can only explain by pointing upwards. In Jesus' mighty name we pray. Amen. Thanks, guys. Go in peace. Thanks.